Welcome to Greycast, exploring the world of Greyhawk one podcast at a time. This podcast is all about bringing the classic World of Greyhawk setting to life through Greyhawk creators, Greyhawk lore, Greyhawk streamers, Greyhawk stories, and of course, the vibrant Greyhawk community of gamers. Thank you for tuning in, and let the exploration of Dungeons & Dragons' most classic and revered setting, the World of Greyhawk, begin now.
Hey, Greyhawkians, welcome to another fabulous episode of Greycast. We are going to be doing some interesting stuff tonight. We've got, of course, good old Mateus, our co-host. What's up, Mateus? Matt?
Hey, how's it going?
Your hair's looking tremendous, by the way.
Thank you. Yes, it's that invisible hair, you know.
Same as mine, man.
Yeah, sometimes you can't see how luxurious it is.
It does. I can only imagine how luxurious it is. Probably as luxurious as mine. So, and we have with us today the one and the only, the Oblivion Seeker, the Seeker of Oblivion, and he is going to prepare us for a ride through, let me bust out my Rod Serling, a ride through Appendix N. Appendix N is what, in the back of the DMG or the player's guide?
DMG.
Yeah. So yep. we're gonna set up a series of discussions over the coming millennia here on Greycast. Because, man, there's a lot. Appendix N is like a mega list of really, like, this is a rabbit hole we may not return from because there's so much stuff. And I think if my debriefing is coming back to me clearly, I think what we're trying to do here is just kind of establish some of the things that you can use as a dungeon master to influence your game. Maybe some of the things that influenced Mr. Gygax and Mr. Arneson as they were hatching their Greyhawk creativity and so forth. So let's introduce Oblivion Seeker, and I'm going to invite you, because this is, I'm just going to tell you right now, I'm already in, I'm not going to say over my head, but I can barely, like, my eyeballs are even with the surface of the water, because I am not familiar with many of these authors. So I'm going to go into sponge note-taking, learny DM mode. And Oblivion Seeker, friend of the show, friend of the podcast, this is your second visit, is that right?
No, I think I've done a few more. I did the appendix and overview. Yep. And I did the episode on the flan, I think.
The flan, that's right.
You did, that's right. So this is probably your third go around. So at any rate, welcome back. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing well.
He gets the regular badge now.
Yeah. The regular. You know what we need to do, though? We need to create a regular badge.
That's right.
And then you can have one.
It'll be the same color as my hair.
Right, and mine, yes. So let's just turn the control of this thing over to Mr. Seeker. And take it away, man. Tell us all about this Appendix N richness.
So let's make a ground thing. In case somebody, we have had a lot of listeners jump on the show recently who maybe haven't gone back and listened to the Appendix N episode. So two minute overview. What the heck is Appendix N, and why should the average DM care?
Appendix N is a list of inspirational reading matter that Gary Gygax included in the first edition Dungeon Master's Guide. In the paragraphs prefacing the list, he talks about the influence of things like Andrew Lang's fairy tales, Grimm's fairy tales, and EC horror comics, and things of that nature on the game. But then he mentions, of course, that a lot of its DNA is lifted from classics of the fantastic literature. And then he proceeds to give you a list of books that either directly influenced him or that he thinks that would be of particular interest to dungeon masters.
And a lot of those are now considered the classics of the fantasy genre.
Indeed. There are also some real There are some books that have aged poorly. There are also some real gems buried among them that are lesser known, and that's going to be one of the emphases of the of this little exploration, I think.
Mm-hmm. And so then up to the second question, why should a Greyhawk DM be interested in reading C.L. Moore or Jack Vance or any of the other names on this list for when they're thinking about crafting a campaign set in Greyhawk?
Sure. I'm going to answer that question with a bit of old school Renaissance or OSR theorizing, right? In the early days of the OSR, there was a lot of discussion about what constituted, you know, an actual, genuine, authentic old school campaign. And one of the phrases that you saw bandied around, I think it was invented by Trent Smith of the Mystical Trash Heap blog, was the idea of the mythic underworld. And that'll be the dungeon where, as you go into it, it's almost like descending into the subconscious mind, right? You have this sense of dreamlike peril and surreality, and where you have these monsters that sometimes represent various themes or psychological forces, right? So it's a very kind of mythic, as this name suggests, a mythic kind of environment. You also have the idea of the funhouse dungeon, which is just basically a wizard did it craziness where everything is clustered together. And then, of course, the idea of Gygaxian naturalism came up, which would be the idea that the dungeon is a living, breathing, changing environment with its own ecology and its own logic, and with alliances between creatures and rivalries between creatures and tribes and so forth. So these are kind of three themes, and they each have their proponents. I think that the scene, if you will, became somewhat balkanized among proponents and advocates of each of those styles of play and each of those kinds of aspects. But the point is that what I'm driving at is you see all three of those environments, I think, reflected in the work of Gygax and in those early TSR modules and in other adventures that were published in that period.
So summarizing, we have the mythic underworld where things get, the deeper you go, the crazier, more uncanny things get. You've got a wizard making crazy things like a themed dungeons.
Yeah, funhouse dungeons.
Funhouse. And what was the third one again?
And the third one would be Gygaxian naturalism.
And these are three different themes that people in the OSR, the old school Renaissance, trying to bring back the old school, old style of play in modern contexts, right? They have taken these things and you have these three camps, but all three, you're saying that all three of these camps can be found in Gygax and in the writings that he cites in Appendix N. Am I picking up what you're...
I would say that that's exactly the point. There's that, and there's the idea that the Greyhawk, at least as we received it and based on what we know of it, would slip between modes. Gotcha. Like, you might have the mythic underworld thing, you might come across, you know, the Easter Island heads in one level of Castle Greyhawk, and right. In another, you might have a portal that takes you to Alice in Wonderland, and in another, you might have rival tribes of orcs, right?
So you have, like, Keep on the Borderlands has its own ecology. Can you give us an example of a module, maybe, of the other two for the other two?
I got one. I know one. Can I you say a thing I know? Because this absolutely is probably all I got right here. I think Tomb of Horrors. Tomb of Horrors. Or the Zagig under Greyhawk. Zagig's thing, the wizard did it, the kind of fun house, and let's see how I can make crazy, crazy things.
Exactly.
I
would say, two other examples would be White Plume Mountain or Ghost Tower of Inverness for your funhouse dungeons.
Right.
And for your Mythic Underworld one, I would think something like the Forgotten Temple of Therizdun as well, where as you're descending, it becomes, you know, weirder and trippier. until you get even, to Black Cyst.
Even maybe the Drow series.
Yeah, absolutely. And the Drow actually tie into one of the authors I'll be discussing. Who's on Appendix N, so
nice.
Good call.
Nice. I know a thing. That's probably it, though. That's probably all I got.
Nah. No.
Nah.
So, and so these themes are in a lot of those different authors in Appendix N, and they show up in different modules that are either by Gary Gygax or have the Greyhawk label or are nominally set in Greyhawk. And
I was going to say that there's also another pair of themes that I think you'll find in a lot of these authors. One would be the idea of the frontier. I mentioned, I think, in the last episode that Robert E. Howard, a lot of his stories take place at various frontiers, right? It might be the right. frontier of the Roman Empire.
Right.
It might be the frontier of Aquilonia. Right. It might be the American
Black
West.
River. That's it, yeah.
Yeah, it might be the American West. Yep. The idea is you have this the frontier and the clash between barbarism in various forms, including outright cruel depictions of savagery, and the idea of civilization for all its for all of its glories and decadence.
Right.
That's a theme that recurs again and again in some of these, even when some of them seem to be borderline science fiction. And a related theme, very closely related theme, would be the idea of a post-apocalyptic setting. Now, by that, everyone's going to be thinking Mad Max and Fury Road and everything like that. But I mean a setting where you had some vast network or kingdom or empire and it collapsed.
Right.
Basically people living among the ruins of Rome, right? The Roman Empire. And you have these things, these sites, these locations that people are exploring, looking to loot.
Right. Yep.
And that's a motif that you find across several of these authors, or dealing with the aftermath of, what happened after the, what happens after the magical rulers disappear? What happens after the super science super science culture collapses and leaves behind bits of technology that no one understands? Or portals to little pocket dimensions where they traveled into. You find that sort of stuff in a lot of the Appendix N authors. And, you might read it and think, well, this novel's set on Mars. And I'm like, well, yes, it is set on Mars. But these motifs, the tomb raiding protagonist who's in it for his own and finds himself way over his head when he finds survivors of some ancient civilization who've been carrying on oblivious of the world outside. And they don't want you to leave. This sort of motif sounds familiar, I think, to most D&D players.
And, so. I've thought of Clark Ashton Smith's writings twice as you were talking, even though he's not on Appendix N, though he very well could be.
Anywhere, very well should have been. Rob Kuntz was a big proponent of Clark Ashton Smith, and it comes across a lot in Kuntz's own work. But he had mentioned that he actually eventually brought Gary Gygax around to going, okay, Clark Ashton Smith's okay. Gygax read it and just bounced off of it for whatever reason.
Well, so, the two things that have struck my mind about him are the story where they go back to they go into the ruined city. And there are other stories that are in the city before it was ruined, but they go into the ruined city to the temple, and there's this dark elder slimy thing that's there attacking them, and they're trying to get out of the temple before it kills them. And that idea of tomb raiding a place where something apocalyptic has happened. You see that in something like that. And then the other story I was thinking of is the one where the guy goes in and he meets Sothagwa, I think,
yeah,
in a cave. And the deeper he goes, the crazier things get.
Exactly. There's also, that kind of thing also relates to, I think over on something that is still prevalent in popular culture, which I think over on TV Tropes and Tropes, they call it sealed evil in a can, where and you can find traces of that even in if you think of the Planet of the Apes movie where you have all the people worshiping the atomic bomb, right? It's a similar kind of, it's the same kind of motif. It's like this ancient civilization left something locked away, and an unwitting and greedy adventurer is like, hey, this looks promising. And you know, bad stuff follows. So yeah, I mean, these are the kinds of motifs that I'm like, you can look at it, you can mine it, you can subvert it, you can play with it. You can, if your players are particularly hip, you can set them up and then frustrate their expectations. It turns out the sealed evil has already been released and is working around them and has been waiting for them, or something like that. So yeah,
and
it's hungry, basically.
I think this is important, and let me use an example from a different fandom to show why this kind of thing is important. Consider the difference between the Mandalorian TV series and the Star Wars sequel movies.
Yeah.
What's the difference? Why did the Mandalorian pick? Why does it have that Lucas-like feel? Because Dave Filoni actually knows the source material, the building blocks behind the scenes, the Seven Samurai and Kurosawa films and Westerns and those kinds of things. And he is able to take those or similar building blocks and use them behind the scenes. And The Mandalorian becomes a hit, and it feels like Star Wars. Why? Because it's using the same building blocks that they did. So this is important for DMs, because if you become familiar with some of these authors, you'll start to learn how to use these same building blocks when you're building your Greyhawk, and your Greyhawk will start to feel more Gygaxian.
And right? You know, yeah, exactly. Along those lines, you know, Matthew, full disclosure, you're a player in my regular campaign.
Yes.
I hope that in the campaign, it has the Greyhawk lore and the, you know, several elements of all the Greyhawk lore, but it also, I hope, captures some of the tone,
right,
of the and feel of those kinds of adventures. And yeah. Because that to me would be a unique Greyhawk thing. It's not just about the lore, right?
Right.
It's also about the feel and the vibe and the atmosphere. Yeah. So and also the fact that you know, it wasn't in a way, when we say that Greyhawk is kitchen sink fantasy, that isn't necessarily a negative, right? That's a feature, not a bug. The idea that it has all these things thrown together and all these disparate subgenres going on is actually to its benefit. It can shift between, say, you know, larcenous rogues in an urban setting to, right, a quest narrative to a planar adventure, you know, portal, basically the character's portal jumping to downright absurdity with the, what the heck is this weird monster coming at me that looks like it's made out of five different things by some factory worker who's been smoking too much meth to finish things. That's kind of my take on it anyway. And regardless, even if someone disagrees with my take, I'm still hoping that people will be introduced to these authors if they're the less familiar ones, or encouraged to go back and look at them again in a second or third reading and see what they can glean from them, because I think many of these are really worthy authors, some of whom have been forgotten.
And I think it's important for people to note, busy people who, you know, have children and jobs and lives, and they can't, you know, they might say to us, but guys, this sounds awesome, but where do I have time to read? I would suggest finding audiobooks. Audible.
Absolutely.
I mean, I listened to, I'm working my way through, blasted, what's it called? The Fritz Leiber, Fafhrd and the Grey Mouser stories. They're all Audible. They're done very well, and I'm working my way through them. So that's that's a way you can listen to some of these if you're busy, there's something to that. I think listening to a story captures some of the old art of storytelling, hearing it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Hearing it being told.
Also, I would suggest with some of these authors, like Fernald is an example. I mentioned that Douglas Fairbanks was in some of those things. If you don't mind old films, you know, unless you have if you don't have an allergy to black and white or early Technicolor films, some of the people who influenced these writers who I'm going to mention as well, just off the top of my head, some authors like Talbot Mundy or Harold Lamb, or I mentioned Geoffrey Fernald, Raphael Sabatini, of course. They influenced Robert E. Howard, they influenced C.L. Moore, they influenced Fritz Leiber. These were the great writers of swashbuckling tales, right? And many of their novels were turned into films. The Seahawk, Captain Blood, you know, so these are these old classic films with Errol Flynn and Douglas Fairbanks. And, you know, they're worth a view. And if you've got kids, these are films that do not contain vast amounts of foul language or gratuitous violence or sex. But they're exciting. And they have really cool sword fighting scenes and action scenes. Which again, if you're a DM and you're looking for how to set up an action sequence for your players, these are worth looking at. So yeah, anyway, that would be my other thing, is feel free to try and find other avenues for exploring some of these ideas.
And
most of these are streaming, you know, it's not that hard to find them nowadays.
Yeah. No, I know, you can get an app called, is it called Just Watch? Just Watch. And you enter your streaming, you put in your streaming services that you subscribe to, and it'll show you what's available. So if people are looking for some of these old flicks, a lot of them are available. If you're wondering, well, where is an Errol Flynn? Where's Errol Flynn Robin Hood available? Well, you type it in Robin Hood, you look for the year, and voila, it's available on, you know, streaming service number 372. And I have a subscription to that.
And, you know, again, throughout this series, one of the other things that I hope to do is this will be a matter of influence and what people were reading and stuff like that. When we get to Clark Ashton Smith, Clark Ashton Smith, when he was starting out as a young poet and writer in San Francisco, translated and read tons of French stuff. And you see a real influence of some of the fin de siècle French symbolist and decadent writers on Smith's tales. And as a matter of fact, in one of his letters, he says that he, you know, at this point in his career, he wanted to shake off the French influence, basically.
He has a set of stories set in
exactly
medieval France or something.
And there's an entire volume of his collected poems that's dedicated to his translations of French poems as well. Baudelaire and everything else. But the point there that I'm making there is that now, courtesy of Brian Stableford and the good people over at Black Coat Press and whatnot, a lot of these authors who influenced Smith and other authors who were reading French or were finding things in a translation are available in really good translations on print on demand. And these are authors who maybe they had a story in Weird Tales, right?
Right.
And matter of fact, there was an Alexandre Dumas, believe it or not, a werewolf tale that was serialized in Weird Tales during the, I believe, the 30s. And these things are now available in print on demand, good quality translations. And again, in many cases, you can find audiobooks nowadays because, you know, it's a market.
So let's say this brings me to another idea, another resource. So let's say you are familiar with some of these authors. Some of them, the more popular ones, of course, don't they have like whole setting books direct published for their set, for their world, some to the varying qualities, but I can think of a bunch off the top of my head. Jack Vance's Dying Earth.
Yeah.
Lankmar has stuff.
Absolutely.
Conan, the Hyperborean Age. What is it? Modiphius.
Modiphius and
Modiphius. Yep.
And before them, of course, you had the D20 Conan.
Right.
And before that, TSR had its own Conan system.
That's right.
And there was also a GURPS Conan, I believe. So yeah.
And then, of course, if you have GURPS, you have MERPS, and Lord of the Rings stuff. And you've used stuff in your Greyhawk from Lord of the Rings. You've used trolls or beefed up goblins
The trolls that I use tend to be, I mean, and this is where Gygax's trolls came from, right? The Paul Anderson, Three Hearts and Three Lions. And so when I describe the limbs twitching on the ground after you've severed them, and the way that the flesh looks like, as if it's moving, there's something moving underneath it, that's basically Paul Anderson's description of his trolls. But yeah, I definitely am not above saying, you know, this scene works.
Right.
And how can I use it, and how can I play with it, and how can I subvert it, and how can I complicate it? Like, there's before you joined the campaign, the earlier set of players managed to encounter, there was a setting that they wound up trapped in. It involved some bandits who had taken over a town, and it was basically Return of Ringo, the Italian Western, fused with another Western that had Klaus Kinski as an avenging ghost figure, a gunslinger, someone out for blood. It was basically those two scenarios crossed with Fritz Lang's Hangman Also Die, a World War II thriller, with also elements of mad scenes from my favorite Italian operas, all mashed together, and then with an overlay where basically everything is raided at the end by a vampiric orc and his minions. And it basically degenerates into a Robert E. Howard type battle sequence. just basically don't feel free to lift, right? And to combine. Yeah. A lot of great storytelling happens that way. That's, you know, if you think about old Marvel comics, they'd take things from whatever that was popular and whatever they had read and just mash the stuff together. And lo and behold, you have narrative, you have character.
And so you have the Appendix N list. You have, we mentioned before, you've got the 5e players can go to the back of their DMG and get kind of a updated list.
Exactly, with Robert Jordan and N.K. Jameson, yeah, and a bunch of stuff like that.
It's bunch of
Aville.
And you have the Mold Bay list in the back of the old red book, the basic.
Yep, basic.
But if you want to get Greyhawk's feel, what's the magic formula from the, you know, is it the, you know, 2 teaspoons of Jack Vance with a pinch of Tolkien with a, you know, a cup of Robert E. Howard? Like,
I think you know, it depends. And it depends on what part of Greyhawk you're playing in.
Now, this is interesting. Expand on that. What you just said, expand on that.
Mm-hmm.
If you're doing Furiondi or Valuna or something like that, it's going to be far more like, at least in my opinion, it'll be far more like the great romances of knights and things like that. You might have more of a feel, and your characters might, by the way, rub up against that. You might have a bunch of rogues wandering into this kind of scene, but the general tone, I think, or what the setting, the figures within the setting will aspire to, is going to be something more akin to Arthurian or Carolingian, like Charlemagne romances. It's going to have that kind of vibe of heroism and honor and valor and things like that. And, you know, and so you might even think of Three Hearts and Three Lions, again, to go back to Appendix N. You might, or any number of, or some of the Elsbreg de Camp stuff. To some extent, you might even think of, if you're familiar with The High Crusade by Anderson, in a weird way, you could actually think of that if you're playing with, IUs or things like that. Except demons instead of things from outer space, right? But yeah, that's one thing. But then, of course, if you're doing an urban setting, you're going to be looking at, like, Shadazar from Robert E. Howard. You're going to be looking at Lankmar.
Right.
And with and when you're dealing with wizards, I do think that you wind up dealing with you're inevitably going to come into texts like some of Zelazny stuff. The Amber novels come to mind, but Darlish the Damned, to some extent, if it's a sort, you know, if you're also doing sword wielding stuff. But also you want Vancy and Irony. I mean, look at the spell names and some of the magic items in the DMG, first edition DMG, and there's a very kind of a Vancian sense of circumambulant peripherization when it comes to naming things. Talking around things. That would be my suggestion, is just think about what you're trying to do, and then think, would this fit that?
I can think of three off the top of my head. I can think of the Grandwood as being the probably one of the pre-586. The Grandwood is probably one of the best places to put a Robin Hood themed or style campaign. You guys are it's a perfect fit for that kind of campaign. The Vespa is a great place if you liked The Hobbit. And you like there's a Dark Lord of the North, there's a contingent of elves and a creepy ass forest with some mountains nearby.
Oh, Mirkwood, I was thinking Vespa and Selene would be really Tolkien-esque parts of the fairness.
And so, you know, there's you can almost see different authors. You can take a look list of these authors, and you can look at the map and you say, oh, this would fit, this type of a campaign would fit really well right here. Pirates, it's got to be the Sea Barons. anything down in the Amedio, the jungles, very pulpy down there, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are all kinds of, and besides that, I mean, think about like the Valley or Vale of the Mage, right? Or think about like the various mountain ranges. I know James Jacobs, it came up yesterday in a conversation online, but I was mentioning that James Jacobs did this thing where a bunch of halfling druids in the Aberals, came across a bunch of dinosaur bones with runes on them, and wound up discovering, at any rate, there's runic magic on dinosaur bones in a lost little site that the druids were attempting to excavate. And you can do that. You can have lost valleys, you know, a la everything from H. Rider, you know, these lost kingdoms and lost valleys, like if everything from H. Rider Haggard through Edgar Rice Burroughs through Robert E. Howard and C.L. Moore kind of things. Caves where people have set up civilizations underground. I mean, the opportunities are endless.
And so talk a little bit. So if we have, like I mentioned before, I can go and play Jack Vance's Dianeryth RPG. I can play a Lankmar or Conan RPG. I can play Lord of the Rings RPG. You know,
Greyhawk? Why D&D?
Why Grey? Yeah. So what's the advantage to Greyhawk incorporating all of these things into one world?
I think that the advantage to it is the advantage that you find in something like, and again, I hate to go back to this, but comics have been a lot of my mind lately, Your reading experience with comic books, say, in the 70s and 80s, and how that influenced later popular culture, where you had the potential for crossover between seemingly disparate modes of play, for lack of a better word, so that you might have Luke Cage and Iron Fist encounter Rom Space Knight, right? And combat alien sorcerers who are shapeshifters. That's the kind of thing that you can get in there. You know, we were talking about the Lord of the Rings. It's like that idea that you can jump from something that's very either pastoral in a way, almost pastoral, like Hobbiton and the Shire, or something that's noble and, you know, militaristic, like some of the cultures, riders of Rohan and stuff like that. You can jump from that to imagine Fafnir and the Grey Mouser turning up in Gondor and the chaos that would ensue. You can't get that when you lock yourself into one narrative mode.
That's right.
And that's the thing is, again, it's that idea that you can shift modes. You can, at least in my campaign, and again, people's mileage may vary, but I love the fact that it's basically fantasy, right? But within that, you're jumping from an espionage narrative to a war, an occupied city post-war narrative to a heist to a straight up horror, cosmic horror, to a more traditional sword and sorcery thing. You're basically moving all these genres, but if it's done well and if you're having fun with it, it's part of a whole. Those disparate elements that were part of separate wholes become part of a new whole. And to me, that new paradigm, that new gestalt is Greyhawk. That was what the genius of D&D and the genius of Greyhawk and other early settings was, that they were kitchen sinks, and yet looking at it, it took on the shape of an art form. It didn't look like a bunch of pots and pans. It looked like a work of art, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. And there's a neat quality to that, because if you're on a, hey, I watched this kick-ass TV show, kick-ass movie, I watched this awesome, I read this awesome fantasy book, and I think, and I have ideas for a really cool campaign, you can do that in Greyhawk.
Yeah, just but my thing is always try to mix in other elements.
Yes, yeah.
Because, you know, if you want to play Game of Thrones, there's a Game of Thrones role-playing game, right?
That's right.
Otherwise, you could play that. But what if you mixed Game of Thrones with some of the environment from a China Mieville novel, and then threw in some druidic weirdness, and then on top of that threw in, you know, elements of The Last Unicorn. Suddenly it's a whole other thing, dude.
That's right.
You can make it your own. It's kind of like the same way that, say, if someone covers a song, I'm thinking here of Ghost covering a song by The Stranglers recently. But in the middle of it, in the bridge, they suddenly start playing part of a Metallica song. And it fits, right? It works, but it shouldn't, because The Stranglers and Metallica are just stylistically different. But the way that they do it, they pull it off. They make the cover version their own thing. And that to me is the thing. You're trying to make Greyhawk your own. You're also pulling in things that you enjoy. And it's that idea of, in a way, mentorship. You're being mentored by the texts, but ultimately you want to internalize these things and make these things your own. And you do that through experience. You do that through, you know, learning how to selectively rob.
And that's important, because when you're thinking about how to make Greyhawk feel like Greyhawk, it can be easy for DMs, newbie DMs like me or other DMs, to lean too heavily into the one or two fantasy genres we know, you know, Lord of the Rings or
that's me,
or and by diversifying your portfolio, so to speak, and open and allowing a dash of Robert E. Howard and Clark Ashton Smith, you can start to emulate the Greyhawk feel. Otherwise, it feels like you mold Greyhawk to be something that you could have done better if you just went out and bought the Lord of the Rings RPG, right? Or the Conan, or, you know, if you want to play Conan, go play Conan. But if you want to play Greyhawk, let's take a dash of Conan and a dash of Jack Vance and a dash of, you know.
I think that's the thing. I mean, the thing is that Gygax offered the great invitation to make Greyhawk your own. Mm-hmm. But there's also the example that he set, I believe, of taking from all these various sources and mixing them together in such a way that Greyhawk has its own personality, its own feel. So if you want to do that, if you want to go and just emulate a genre or a work that you like, you can. You know, no one's going to put a gun to your head. The fun police are not going to kick in your door. And far be it for me to don the badge and the gun and call myself, you know, the enforcer of the fun police. Far be it for me to do that. Or anyone else, I would argue. But you can go ahead and, like I said, if you start doing this stuff, if you start thinking about how does this fit, how does that fit, I really like this element in the book, but I don't like these other things, or this stood out to me, right? Like, sometimes you'll read a book or watch a movie, and you'll actually, it'll invade your dreams, right? Or you'll be thinking about it for days, and it's like, how do I do that, or how do I take that, or how do I do something like that for my players? How do I get inside their heads so that this collective experience that we have is something that they will carry forward with them? I mean, there's so much, like I said, there's so many different angles. Like, one of the things I hope to go into is, again, you have a book like Hiro's Journey, right? Sterling Lanier, which is on Appendix N. And here's the question. Why would a post-apocalyptic novel, in the normal sense, the sense that we might think of it, which seems more akin to Gamma World, be on Appendix N? Right. And I would argue it's because of the main character Hiro. In many ways, he belongs to, without going into details, because I want to come back and look at these books, but his relationship with his animal companions, and also the idea that he is sent on by the organization to which he belongs on a quest to prevent these people who are attempting to resurrect pre-apocalyptic technology and stuff for their own ends. You could easily see how elements of that, either when you're talking about the druids, when you're talking about the old faith, or elements of the plot, someone discovered something and we don't want them to use it, could be applicable to Greyhawk.
Absolutely.
And I think a lot of that probably fed into Gygax's thinking. You know, when you read the Gord of Greyhawk novels, there's a little bit, I would argue there's probably a little bit of Hiro in Curly Greenleaf. So,
go ahead.
Just things like that.
Mm-hmm. And what about some of the other major Greyhawk authors? I mean, like Sargent.
Oh yeah. I think
does this list also did they read these, were they reading these same things?
I would certainly imagine so. Sargent is of that age, and of course worked of the age of people who were working at Games Workshop, right? He's of that generation, and he was working at Games Workshop, and he did some work for Games Workshop prior to coming over and doing, or prior to doing a bunch of freelance work for TSR. And he did a lot of work for Warhammer Fantasy, where I think you can see some of the same influences that you see at work in his Greyhawk thing. You have elements of Moorcock, you have elements of Tolkien, you have elements of folklore, and obviously he was into parapsychology. He did a lot of supposed to have done a lot of research on ESP and telepathy and things like that, right? But within that domain, you'll notice the recurring thing, certainly in his Shadowrun work, would be the emphasis on the Fey. And, you know, you have he develops the idea of the fading lands and stuff, and you have that element as well in Shadowrun, except the idea is that these lands aren't fading, they're actually now here. there's definitely that connection to the sort of material that you find either on Appendix N or that Gygax refers to in those prefatory statements. Fairy tales, right?
Right.
And speaking of which, again, I would say we won't really cover this. We might touch on some of it, but don't feel obligated, or one shouldn't hold up one's nose because, hey, this is fairy tales. There's a lot of cool dark material, and a lot of cool morally and psychologically complicated material within fairy tales. Obviously, Tolkien was a big fan. But also, when you're looking at fairy tales and folklore, and which is another, I think, big influence on Sargent, you can look at that and you can say, hey, there's this element. There's the troll under the bridge, which actually Gygax used in a later adventure. There's this kind of notion of this almost dream logic, right? With the princess and the pea. Or there's this thing that's fundamentally frightening. I mean, you know, this image, this iconography of the witch in the woods, right? Whether she's in a gingerbread house or just standing around a fire with a cauldron. These things take on kind of resonances with people. And you can subvert them as well. And also, I was going to mention, like, John, one of the authors that we will probably wind up discussing, John Bellairs, The Face in the Frost is, of course, on Appendix N. And he hadn't really, Gygax mentioned that he hadn't really read or finished it, when he put it on the list, it had that same sort of spirit that he was looking for, right? Now, the thing about Bellairs is he also wrote children's books. And among those children's books, you know, you have, what's the name of it? The House with the Clock in the Wall, I think. The House with the Clock in its Walls, which was made into a film. And if you were to read those children's books, they're surprisingly rich and dark. And I would argue if you're doing a funhouse dungeon or you're doing something with traps and puzzles, I don't care if those are kids' books. Those could be manuals for how to mess with your player. So I highly recommend looking at stuff like that. Or even if you're running a horror theme, if you're, you know, even putting aside Greyhawk, although you can do horror in Greyhawk, certainly, but if you were doing something like a Ravenloft campaign or your characters wind up in Ravenloft, you could benefit from reading his children's novels. And they have great Edward Gorey illustrations, a bunch of them. So highly recommended.
Your comment about fairy tales reminds me of a quote by G.K. Chesterton in his essay on The Red Angel. It's popularly paraphrased as fairy tales don't tell children that dragons exist. Children already know that dragons exist.
Yeah, exactly.
Fairy tales tell children that dragons can be killed.
Exactly.
A similar cute quote could probably be given for most of these authors.
Absolutely.
Kind of a insert monster here, yep. Depending on the author and the genre.
Yeah.
So, man, we've covered some ground here. I feel like what you've done for us here, sir, is kind of provide a baseline of what's going to be coming as we take sort of like this was a preview to, as we were talking off air, earlier, a preview to the deeper dives as you take each author and go deeper and provide more specific examples, maybe an author or two per episode as we explore this. And gosh, I was looking at that appendix N, there's 29 authors.
Exactly.
Probably now, no need to do like Tolkien, you know, the better known ones, but the more obscure ones, I'm kind of anxious to hear the ideas I can get as a DM that you're going to be able to share with us.
I'm wanting to look at more at those obscure ones. I'm wanting to look more at some authors who people probably know their name, but might not be familiar with the work, like Lee Brackett or C.L. Moore. Mm-hmm. And also writers who I think have been sadly neglected or relegated to, you know, this is old timey stuff, like Andre Norton, who was a huge figure in genre fiction and still is hugely influential, but a lot of people haven't necessarily read her stuff. And she wrote the first Greyhawk novel, actually, Quag Keep. Or Margaret St. Clair, who there's a reason that The Shadow People is on Appendix N. And without going into spoilers, if you're interested in The Underdark, it was a major influence on The Underdark, and we'll be looking at how and why that is. And then, you know, also Don Bellairs, and maybe we'll look at some Paul Anderson. Not that he's neglected or forgotten, but because a lot of people aren't familiar with his fantasy work. And we'll also be mentioning a few things that are, you know, it might be worth looking at Fritz Leiber and Jack Vance at an angle, like not just that stuff, but in general, as authors, what do they teach us?
Mm-hmm.
And what can be used. So that's a general idea of what I think we will be doing.
Well, cool. This is going to be an interesting series. And again, you know, I'm just not familiar with most of those authors. So I know I'm going to benefit as a DM. My players hopefully will benefit as ideas begin to pour in and notes are taken. Cause my thing is really all Tolkien. I'm just a Tolkien snob, and I'm not even that well versed, you know, compared to other J.R.R. Tolkien files, but that's what I'm familiar with. So I'm kind of looking forward to getting that benefit of your experience and Matt's experience with these different authors and seeing, like, I never even considered that there's probably specific authors who influence the various regions based on how those regions are set up politically or geographically and how they're populated. So,
how we can go back and use those, you know, it's this kind of environment, so let's use this kind of literature for it.
Right. Right. Here's a tie to something similar. Right. Like you were talking about Furiondi being Arthurian and so forth. So yeah. Looking forward to this. So,
cool. So am I, and I want to emphasize just, you know, as a kind of final statement, I just want to emphasize this is not proscriptive. This is not intended as if you don't do your homework, you suck. This is just here's some cool stuff. Here's how it influences or appears to have influenced some of the things that you'll find in the world of Greyhawk, and you can run with it or not run with it or choose what you want to run with. It's just basically recommendations in the same way that the list was a list of recommendations for inspirational reading. So keep that in mind. It's not at all intended to be, you must read this or you're not cool.
Right. No, it's a way of doing your D&D game.
Yeah.
You can derive character inspiration from these things. Doesn't have to be for DMs only. So right. I just see this as another way of looking at a way to set up your world or your character to inform your game or not. If it's not your jam, that's cool too.
Exactly.
And every once in a while, we'll have Oblivion Seeker back on. We'll do another installment, and in between, you'll get your lore dumps on realms and interviews with creators from the content creators and our normal stuff. But we thought this would be a neat recurring series.
Yeah, we've got a few kind of recurring things running now. So, definitely pays not to miss any episodes. So, very good. Well, Oblivion Seeker, thank you very much for joining us. And as Mateus said, we'll have you on again very soon to start the deeper dive into individual authors.
Hey, thank you guys. And I also thank you for doing the podcast. It's always a revelation and a pleasure.
It's fun. It's, man, I've learned so much. Thankfully, I take notes because I've remembered very little of it. So you get to that age as an old hobbit, and you know,
I know the
past
feeling.
11-1, you know, it gets painful.
So. I know the feeling, and I'm not a hobbit. So
yeah, I think that's a universal process.
Yeah, so. Experience there.
Unless you're from Canada, then that's a universal process.
That's there you go. Exactly right.
All right. Well, thanks for listening. And gosh, we'll be back in just a couple of weeks with goodness knows what shenanigans. And until such time that we do return, please be nice, be safe, and we'll see you somewhere out in the pathways of Greyhawk.
You've been listening to the Greycast podcast, where we explore the world of Greyhawk one podcast at a time. Mateus and I are excited to share our passion for the world of Greyhawk with each of you. We'll drop episodes every other Monday featuring all things Greyhawk. Please refer us to all your cool, nerdy Greyhawkian friends and allies, even your most hated enemies at the gate. You can find our podcast on Spotify and be sure to give us a follow on Twitter at Greycast576 to keep up with Greycast. Until next time, remember, it's a dangerous business going out your door. You step onto the road, and if you don't keep your feet, there's no knowing where you might be swept off to.